From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in January of 2014. That was the first month I hosted the show. And as I worked on creating guest lists for that first month, one name immediately came to mind. John Vito had been a small business owner, the kind who gives just about every hour of his day to his work. His first shop was called Obagelos, which I always thought was a misleading name. This was not just a bagel shop down on State Street, not far from WXXI. The hunks of fresh bread were enough to bring the entire Atkins diet industry to its knees. The soups, my God, the soups. The meat was carved right in the back. No processed deli meat. Slabs of roasted turkey. The chicken salad was balanced on a knife's edge. The cookies were like warm hugs from whatever your personal deity might be. And there was John, just not taking any crap from anyone about anything. I feared for the customers who would try to order food while talking on a cell phone. John would not have it. His sign indicated he wasn't going to alter his menu to suit individual tastes. He worked his tail off, and if you didn't like it, you could probably find other places to eat. But he was also so generous. He was loving and kind and smart. He wanted to build something real in this city, a place people could go and engage with one another and engage with the issues in their world. John was an avid reader and a news consumer, and often newsmakers were in his shop. Judges, lawyers, politicians. When I first arrived in Rochester, it was 2003, and 13 Web video journalist Paul DePascal, I work with Paul a lot, he told me he always knew where we would find the best soup and sandwich wherever we were working that day. And so our first destination together? To meet John Vito. We would make excuses to cover stories downtown just so we could have lunch with him. I remember the first time he invited me to his Christmas party, it felt like I was getting a golden ticket. And eventually, John launched a second business called Baked and Carved. He would work 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. That's maybe why he didn't even notice his own health deteriorating. He was losing weight and not feeling well. And one day, a friend told him, you've got to get to a doctor. The doctor informed John that he probably should have had a stroke. He was in renal failure. He didn't leave the hospital for 30 days. He was headed for dialysis and needed a transplant. And his primary care doctor told him, he was surprised John ever left that hospital, and thank God he did. On Connections in 2014, John told me the hospital sent him a bill for $75,000. He had no insurance and no savings. He had poured it all into his shops. But the Affordable Care Act, in John Vito's words, saved his life. John knew he would have to close his businesses and focus on his health. That was a tough blow for the community he had built. But his friends know that he was going to keep cooking, and he did. He launched Cooking for Your Kidneys. It was a video series for people who love to eat but are living with kidney disease. And I last saw John during the jazz festival a couple of years ago in a crowded bar. He flagged me down on the street. He wanted to introduce me to some old friends and former customers because John basically seemed to know everyone. I didn't see him during the pandemic. John's got better friends than me, but he wanted to be very careful because of his immunocompromised state. He was only 56, and last week we lost him. John had picked up an infection. We're going to learn a little bit more about it this hour because he cared about his health and he wanted to educate others. But now, finally, John gets some well-earned rest. So this hour is not just about John. Oh, damn. Sorry, everybody. It's about what it takes to build real community and to live authentically and to pour yourself into work that you believe in. And I don't think very many people did it better. So here to bail me out. I am so glad I have help here. Jeff Spivak, do you want to host the rest of the hour? It's in your capable hands.
Yeah, John. Yeah, John was great. Evan, I feel your pain. I really do. And John was the kind of guy where I would show up for a sandwich and just hang for the conversation.
Yeah.
The cool people that would be there. And I always felt educated walking out that door.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank God Maggie Donlin, Margaret Donlin and Liz Chatterton are here. Margaret, I am so grateful you're here. Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and Liz, thank you.
Thank you.
They both wrote the most beautiful, touching tribute to me. They knew John much better than people like me, and you could see the impact he has. So If I could just start by asking you what your first memory of John is. Margaret Donlan, do you want to start?
Sure. I worked at Obagalo's as a young 20-something. I'm also a teacher in the city school district, so it was a great job for me to have over the summer, mm-hmm. make a little extra money. My first memory of John is I started working there through a friend, Patty Deegan, and I thought I kind of knew what was going on. I could organize things and bake things, and John was always just full of lessons and weird quirks as well. He didn't allow, one thing I do remember, he didn't allow ketchup in Obagalo's.
I love that.
He thought, and I quote, ketchup is a bad use of the tomato, because he really, he thought that the tomato was a sacred vegetable, and he did not allow anyone to bring ketchup in. He didn't serve it. He didn't want anyone to eat his food with ketchup on it. So that was always kind of a funny thing. But he also, you know, used a lot of ketchup or used a lot of tomatoes in his cooking, which a lot of his cooking developed when he was a kid with his mother. And she died at a fairly early age as well. I think she died when he was about 18 or 19 in college. So a lot of what he cooked was things that he learned from his mother as well. Mm.
Liz, your first memory?
As Margaret said, John was very much full of lessons, and he had a mantra. I also worked at Obagalo's. I was a little younger when I started, about 16, and he was big on, you know, if you have time to lean, you have time to clean. And he never would tell you, you know, how to do something, but he would meticulously watch you and then help you figure it out yourself, like what you were doing wrong. So I always think of him whenever I do top-down cleaning, because I'll never forget, I was cleaning out the cooler and I started on the bottom shelf. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, that's wrong. It's, now why would you do that? Now what happens when you go to the top shelf? All of the stuff falls down. And yeah, he was just, but, you know, he was tough on his employees. I think you had mentioned earlier, you know, he had a high standard. And I think, you know, that has translated to so much more of my life. Like, you know, I was used to being an overachiever, and John just pushed all the time. You know, you could be doing things better, you could be doing things smarter. And at the same time, he was the kindest person. You know, if I was working a shift and he knew I had a family dinner after, he'd send me home with fresh baked bread, or, you know, just, you couldn't have met a kinder, gentler person, but he was always striving to do better.
What was the best thing he made, Liz?
Oh my gosh, the oyster artichoke bisque, mm-hmm. which he refused to taste. He didn't eat it.
Why?
I don't know if he just didn't like oysters.
Because it was divine. Oh, Margaret?
But it was so good.
He was actually, he had a very severe allergy to shellfish.
Oh.
So when he made it, he would wear gloves, wear, I don't even know if masks weren't really in at that point, but he made that, you know, for other people, and he would always have people taste it to make sure it was right, but he had a shellfish allergy, so he never ate it.
How do you make something that is that divinely good that you can't taste? You were nodding over there, Jeff Spivak.
I was a big fan of that soup.
Kind of stopped your blood, slowed down your blood a little bit, warmed your whole body.
Whatever he wouldn't eat, I would eat for him.
Jeff, when you think about you know, the area around where we are, because we're not far from where Obagalo's was, right? And we don't have a whole lot of places right here where you can walk to and be at and sort of spend an hour and eat and talk to people and pass the time. And to me, that's part of what makes community. It's no offense to fast food. I understand everything has its place, and I wish people could see Jeff Spivak's reaction to that comment. but there was something unique and really sui generis and I think important about what John did, whether he even knew it or not. How do you build something like that? How important is that to a community?
He's one of those individuals who was just ignite something, a conversation or bringing up an issue, and he was very involved in whatever the issues of the day were, either locally or around the world. But he just had a way of just starting a conversation. And I would be there and just eavesdrop on what was going on in that place and come out of it smarter.
Usually there were some, again, I don't say this as like a, John is not the type of person who ever cared to brag that a mayor or a judge or a high watt attorney was in there. But those people were in there all the time. They were there along with people from all walks of life. But did you find, like I did, we'd be sitting there and I'd be like, Paul DePascal and I would be down there, you know, having our soup and sandwich, and turn around and there would always be people that I needed to interview who wouldn't call me back, and I'd find them at Obagalo's and I'd say, you know, you didn't call me, but you're here having a sandwich, and they would go, oh, damn, I guess we better talk now.
Well, I suppose the attraction was the place was really good, but, you know, there must have been something else more to it. I just think people just picked up on the fact that there was always a little buzz going on in there. Something was happening. He would put up copies of the local paper up there until he got mad at him, then he tore him down. But, you know, he always wanted to generate conversation. And even if you and he were the only people in there, he was busy, he's doing sorting bread and he's still talking to you. He was just a magnet for conversation. And I can't think of a place right now where I would hear that much stuff coming out of one person on so many diverse issues, whether you're talking about local city government or the Red Sox.
Yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, Margaret, how would you describe his passions for, whether maybe we're talking about how politically interested he was or just sort of socially and culturally interested he was, how would you describe it?
He was definitely an avid reader and researcher of all things, especially politics and local politics as well. Again, he knew a lot of people from Obagalo's personally. He got mad at people sometimes. I also remember when I was working there, one of the things in opening at one point, I can't remember who he was mad at. Maybe it was the DNC.
Probably.
but I'm not sure. But one of the tasks for opening was that he had probably about 20 copies of the Bill of Rights laminated, and he would, one of the things was you have to drop them on the floor because someone was trampling his amendments. That went on for a couple years, but that was just, you know, one of the things that he was. You know, really interested in history, really interested in classical literature, really interested in, you know, current things like Black Lives Matter. He read a lot of stuff about that and, you know, was very interested in that as well.
Were the Dr. Seuss books for him?
Yeah, the Dr. Seuss books. I don't know if he rethought that. I think he did. I mean, we talked about it a few times. I don't know if he rethought his love for Dr. Seuss most recently. I believe he did, but I did find a little framed thing of Dr. Seuss book that he gave me years ago.
If I remember correctly, the place closed at 3:12, mm-hmm. and he told me when he went to paste the numbers on the window, he was out of zeros. So it was like, well, I guess we're closing at 3:12. Is that correct, Liz? Is Mike remembering that?
That is correct, and he stuck to it.
Yep, I can confirm as well.
Closed at 3:12, and then ambitiously he had listed his days. Monday he had for golfing. I don't think he played a lot of golf. I think that was when he opened that business. I think he was ambitious about how much time he would get off. Is that also correct?
Yes. Yes.
I mean,
the man did not take much time off.
Yeah, and so I want to talk a little bit about his health right now, because John cared so much when he lost those businesses. He cared about not only still being engaged, being active, still cooking, but also impacting people. And the way he described it on this program back in 2014, he had lost a lot of weight, and you know, people who knew him knew it, but he said that, you know, he was so engaged. He had opened a second business, Baked and Carved, inside Salinger's, I think, right? And
yep.
So he was up at 5 a.m. He was done at 9 p.m., doing it again the next day. And he was thinking, well, I'm just run down. I'm not taking care of myself. That's what happens until, I mean, who grabbed him, Margaret, and said, you've got to see a doctor?
I believe it was Joe D'Amelio and John Feldman and Jill Feldman. And it actually turns out that his blood pressure was running so high that, you know, that's considered the silent killer. And again, he didn't have health insurance, like you mentioned. He was fairly doctor averse as well. So they did finally get him, and another friend, Ned Kelly, I believe, dropped him off at the doctor and then the emergency room. But it was quite remarkable that the way his blood pressure was, the doctor didn't think he would make it to the emergency room from the office.
Yeah, and so on this program, you know, he dropped some hard truths about small business ownership, particularly before 2010, before the Affordable Care Act, because, I mean, I don't think anybody thinks the ACA is perfect, but John Vito was the first person who said to me, it saved my life. You know, when somebody drops a bill in your lap for $75,000, or I have a brother who broke a leg, broke a tib and fib and was given a bill of $110,000. You know, if you don't have resources, it's over for you. What do you do? And John always told me that at the very least he got a bridge to coverage through the ACA. But he said, Evan, you have no idea how many small business owners, we don't even think about insurance. We can't afford that. That is not even on the menu as an option for me. It wasn't for years. He said he just went for years without it. You know, Liz, you're nodding, but I mean that is a hard, hard reality for people who are just trying to get by.
Oh yeah, it's terrible. I remember I was living out of town when he first got sick, and I think there was a DNC article about it where he talked a lot about it, and it just doesn't compute to me that someone who works that hard could be in that position.
Yeah, I mean, Margaret, what would you say about, you know, maybe the lesson that we should take from that? Because that is a scary situation.
It is. And, the healthcare premiums for people that are self-employed are so high without the ACA, and even, you know, they're high with the ACA as well, particularly people that, you know, aren't extremely wealthy and don't have a lot of cash flow. But it's very important that people have health insurance and can go see the doctor. And for somebody like John, that wasn't a priority because it was just too far out of reach. And once the ACA was approved, I remember him explaining it to me from his own personal perspective and how important that was, because he was on dialysis for 5 years after the renal failure, and then he ended up receiving a kidney transplant at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. That was actually about 5 years ago.
2016, I think.
Yeah. So, he was looking at a lot of, medical expenses, the amount of medications he was on alone were thousands and thousands of dollars a month that, the ACA helped him through that.
Yeah, to that point, Margaret, I think he used the word maintenance with me, where he said, a lot of people think about that first big bill, whatever it is, whatever has happened to you, but often there's rehab or maintenance or other care, and the bills can blow your mind if you're not insured. So, and Jeff Spivak, is there a lesson about healthcare in this country, even if one person's story can tell us something? What does John's story tell you?
Well, I'm always astonished at how slow our society is to reacting to a critical need. And when you meet somebody and spend time with somebody who has that experience, okay, we need to learn from this. And I think I know John was very interested in spreading the word about his particular issues. He sent me a copy of the book he wrote, Cooking for Your Kidneys. And I looked at that book, and I was astonished at the level of, I'm not a doctor, but the level of the discussion as far as what food could do for you and to keep you healthy. And it's not the kind of thing that I normally thought about myself. My friends know that. But John became acutely aware of that, and became his mission to push this idea that, okay, it's kidney centric, but this is important, and that bleeds out into other thoughts about your health. And that became the part of his life that whenever I would encounter him on the street or at the jazz festival, most often, that's what he was working on. That became his life. We need people like that to direct us towards the correct way to look at ourselves.
And still to enjoy, I was going to use the phrase comfort food. I mean, some of what he did was really good comfort food. But, you know, you're probably not thinking about phosphorus, and you're probably not thinking about so many other things that are in food or certain levels until you have to. John provided a great service for that. He was nationally recognized for that. I wonder, Liz, and Margaret especially, I hope that what his work there will live on for a long time, and it will touch people. You think it will?
Yeah, I think so. In gathering some things for his obituary, he worked very specifically with the Northeast Kidney Foundation. And when I opened up the website to find the link, you know, copy and paste the link, there he is at the top header. Now, I don't even think, I'm assuming they know that he passed away now, but there he is with the link to his podcast and the link to his book. And that Northeast Kidney organization works, you know, with the National Kidney Foundation as well. So he had a lot of contacts through that organization. So he is there, you know, beautiful picture, some kind of professional photo that he had done, and links to many things, including videos, which I haven't been able to watch quite yet because I'm still processing. But, you know, I thought to myself, I won't be able to talk to him on the phone or hear his voice anymore. Yeah. But no, wait, a friend reminded me. John Feldman reminded me, no, we have all the videos, Margaret. We can watch it anytime. And he's an entertaining guy. I'm going to give him that compliment right now. But he's a very entertaining guy.
What do you think, Liz?
Yeah, I mean, I ended up actually moving in across the street from John when I moved back to Rochester. So I worked for him about 20 years ago and then spent the last 5 or so years as his neighbor. And every single time I would run into him, he would, you know, was updating me on the latest thing he was working on. And I work in marketing and advertising now, so he was always, you know, asking for advice and how he could do it better. And I mean, just since his passing, I've had so many people reach out and say, you know, I didn't know him personally, but I loved his Food and Stories blog, or, you know,
Food and Stories was great.
Just, you know, I think that those things will absolutely live on, as they should. I think they, you know, they're still doing a lot for people.
Yeah, I mean, it's still so surreal talking about the passing of John Vito, who was, he was a small business owner. He was someone who had to give up those businesses, the brick and mortar businesses, when he suffered kidney disease. But John poured himself into his work to help keep cooking and educating people, and that work will certainly live on. We're talking to Margaret Donlan, Liz Chatterton, Jeff Spivak, people who knew John, talking about the community that he built. And, you know, maybe just closing the loop on John's health. Margaret, the news was shocking to me because I think a couple of months ago on Facebook, John was offering advice for people, just making sure people are considerate, whether it's masking or other things, for people who are immunocompromised. You know, we're in this weird society where masks became political. And even today, if you wear a mask somewhere, some people might give you grief about it. You know, you don't know if that person has cancer. You don't know if that person is immunocompromised, but people just want to judge immediately and make these sort of political statements all the time. And that was one of the last things I saw John writing about. It was just nice. I think just kindness. You know, be aware. Immunocompromised people are out there. So I know that John, you know, had immunocompromised issues, but I think sometimes when you've got a friend, I have a cousin who just had a kidney transplant. And in your brain, when you have someone you love who needs that, and then they get it, and they receive it pretty well, you tend to start taking for granted their health a little bit, if that makes sense. So I think that's why I was shocked, because I thought, no, John got the trend. Like, no, this can't be. So what can you give us? Because I know John cares about helping people with their own health, What can you tell us about what happened with that? Again, I don't think we're intruding too much here.
No, and John was always very honest and open and forthright, brutally honest about his health condition.
Yeah.
With the kidney transplant and the dialysis and all of that. But one of the things that was really shocking to me, and I don't know if John knew it, but the reason he was hospitalized was that he had a case of the shingles, which is a pretty common thing that people get. I've had a lot of friends that have it, and mm-hmm. They say it's painful, but they pretty much recover in a couple weeks. But John actually had the shingles, and because he was on so many immunosuppressants, that apparently he couldn't get the shingles vaccine because that's one of those vaccines that it's still live. There's a few. I did some research. There's a few that are still live that you just run the risk. You can't get it because it doesn't work for you, or there's too many risks. So he had the shingles, which turned into a very serious brain infection. And that brain infection, there is treatment for it and Strong treated him for that. But oftentimes when you get this particular brain infection that's so serious, you're infected long before you know it. So he was treated, and the people at Strong 8-1200 neuromedical ICU were fantastic and smart and some of the most compassionate, brilliant people I have ever experienced in my life, and I'll never forget them. But they're some of the most brilliant minds working on this. And unfortunately, that was one of the risks that John had to deal with, being on these immunosuppressant drugs. Something I certainly didn't know. Most of us didn't know. I don't even know if he knew. I mean, there's so many risks that we don't know, but that's something that I think John would want people to know, because of his dedication to giving people lessons about, how to stay healthy with food and how to, take care of yourself when you need it, that sort of thing. So I think it would be really important to him that people knew that. He was also the model transplant recipient, mm-hmm. He didn't go anywhere for a year and a half. And, that's really hard for me to think about now, because you lose that time and you think, oh, he's at home, whatever, he's doing his thing. And, you talk to him every couple times a week, and he would make food and tell me to come over. I would talk to him in the driveway masked. But he really didn't go anywhere other than, to get essentials and groceries to cook for all of his friends. So, again, it's really, really tragic. It feels unfair. Also, I'd like to mention that his kidney, that would be the first thing everyone would infer, that, oh, it was a problem with his kidney. But his transplanted kidney, that wasn't the best version of a transplant anyone had ever gotten, worked in his normal range up until 2 days before his death. Oh. So isn't that a beautiful thing?
Wow.
That actually really comforts me, because and also every single treatment that he was getting caused acute kidney damage. We got to be careful with this antiviral. We got to be careful with this procedure because causes acute kidney damage. So that alone it was a brilliant approach to, to help him. But unfortunately, it didn't work.
Wow. Liz, is it surreal to you, given the fact that, John spent, 5 years waiting for a transplant, as a lot of people do, and then find that joy of at least getting it?
Yeah. I don't know anyone who's fought harder for their health. So it does, as Margaret said, it feels really unfair. I was sharing with her, shortly before we came on, I would see him being his neighbor across the street. And for a while, I was like, oh, man, he doesn't look so good leading up to his transplant. And you would worry. And then, most recently, it's like, oh, he looks great. He seems so happy. And, he's doing so many great things. And like you said, you kind of take it for granted. And I just figured everything was in the clear and on the up and up. So I think it makes it a little extra hard to take, just knowing that he had fought so hard for so long and come so far.
And Jeff Spivak, you know, again, looking at a broader lens at our society, there's a lot of lessons from John, but I'm glad to hear that, you know, that his kidney really fought for him and did well for him. And I know he fought for his health, as Liz says here. But John is someone I will always keep in mind when people want to give anybody grief about wearing a mask somewhere. He protected himself. John was not reckless. He cared about him, you know, his health, to make sure it was as buttoned up as it could be. And yet imagine a guy like him going out now getting grief. You know, take the mask down. The pandemic's over. I cannot. It's hard enough losing somebody like that. But one lesson should be more kindness and more just openness that we don't know what someone's going through. What do you think, Jeff?
And more education. You know, I talked to John about many different kinds of issues over the years. I remember asking him about, John, is bread really good for you? And he was defensive about that, as he probably should have been. You know, but I think that he was also open to whatever the arguments would be about cut back on that or just things in general that he was interested in. I think he was always wanted to know what the latest was on that. And, you know, for me, the most of the time I talked to him, it was usually about what was going on in city government or in the city itself. He always seemed to have the latest news on what was going on. I don't know. I guess it was just the people who walked into Obagalo's or the people he associated with on his days.
Everybody
golfing.
Talked to him.
Yeah. Well, he was that kind of a guy. He seemed to have this extra gear that would engage you. You know, what do you think of this? And I'm like, well, I don't know. He would have to educate me a bit.
Yeah. And Jeff, there were a number of sort of modes of interaction I had with John sometimes if it was about sort of news related stuff. First of all, if I would say something that I was hearing or that I thought was real, I can still picture him kind of at the counter, just kind of going like this, going, oh, you think so, huh? Because mm-hmm. Yes. It was his way of going, no. Yeah, right. And I've got the inside story and you don't. And I'd go, what do you know? And he was like, you know, and I was like, this guy knows everything. The other thing is that if I wanted to talk politics or anything sort of on the news with him, John's the kind of person who he made you smarter because if you're going to defend a position, you have to be informed. And I like having friends like that because they push you not to be half-read, read half an article, declare yourself an expert, because he was going to knock you down if you weren't prepared entering a conversation.
Yeah, he could be a little gruff when in the argument, you know, like...
Well, especially if you earned it.
Yeah. And I earned it a lot, you know, but yeah, he was... I don't think he ever looked at confronting a friend about an issue as being something that would break up the relationship. It would be just something that would advance it.
Well, let's ask the people who worked with him. Liz, what do you think of that?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know if you remember, there was a small chalkboard hanging up, and every day he would put a quote on the chalkboard.
Oh, yeah.
And he was so particular about what he would pick, and sometimes it was from the news, sometimes it was from a book. But I remember I asked once if I could pick the quote, and you had to earn it. You had to prove to him that you know, I like was practically giving a thesis on why my quote should go up, and it never did.
And you never got it?
No. I mean, even picking the music, like he was, you know, the attention to detail that he put into that place. But, you know, I think I'm a much better, you know, like you said, a lot of lawyers and judges came in, and I think they enjoyed debating with him. You would hear him, you know, just go back and forth, and, you know, he would give the best arguers a run for their money because he was always the most informed guy in the room somehow.
Mm. What do you think, Margaret?
Yeah, I agree. I remember the quote chalkboard well, too. There were several books of quotes that he had. And I'm also an English teacher, so I love quotes myself. But he would let me pick once in a while if he wasn't there, of course. But he would ensure that we were picking something that matched whatever was going on in the world nationally, or you know, worldwide, or something in the city that that spoke to, you know, the advancement of integrity, of the advancement of someone's strength and character. Or the uncovering of some, you know, deep, dark secret. So it was a lot of the things that he did, everything that he did was really well thought out, almost to an annoying degree as well. You know, we'd talk about things at breakfast and he would analyze and want to talk about things for 3 months before he did them. So he was that guy.
Before I kick it to break, I just have to ask Jeff Spivak about one more point that Margaret's raising here. The level of detail, aren't the best artists always the ones who, every little detail, whether it is someone in food, music, they care about those little details.
That's what makes the difference. I mean, we all have broad opinions about things and have heard tell of this or that, but when you encounter somebody, an artist or just a smart friend who has a detail that just illuminates everything, that's John.
Well, after our only break of the hour, I want to ask Margaret and Liz their views about an email I got. Just someone who said, didn't know John, wish I had known him, sounded like a great person, sounded like a great boss. What makes a great boss? I'm very curious. What makes a good friend? And what makes someone really, I think an effective community builder? Because we are at a time where more and more it feels like, you know, if we don't all agree on everything, then we can't even sit at a table together. And that was not Obeglos. We have to be able to do this. We have to be able to sit down and be in each other's presence and sometimes break bread together and do that. And that's what we were so grateful for with John Vito, whose work not only lives on in that way, but his work helping in his cooking for your kidneys, that will live on. We lost John Vito recently at the age of 56, and we're talking to Margaret Donlin, Liz Chatterton, Jeff Spivak, and I'm holding it together for you, John. We're coming right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, there's been a lot of talk in the last year about new ways to support kids, child tax credits, other forms of helping parents and families. Well, now it's actually happening. The money is flowing, but where is the money? How do you get it? Is it working? Who's eligible? We'll try to answer your questions Monday on Connections.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. January 14th was the day, 2014, I had John Vito on this program. The reason, by the way, I had him on the program 2 weeks into my stint of hosting this show, which is now 7-plus years on here, is because a lot of people were wondering where John was. I mean, he had gotten sick in 2011. It was 2014. And I said, well, this is my show. I can bring in John and talk. I mean, I love talking to John. And it was wonderful as ever. Conversations with him were always interesting. They were always informed. You know, as I mentioned, I think he made you a better thinker. But one of our listeners asked what it makes for a good boss. And he said they said, boy, John sounded like a good boss. Liz, you touched on this a little bit here, but give me a little bit more about what it was like working with and for him.
He was tough on us. You know, you couldn't get away with anything. You know, here I'm a 16-year-old, you know, kid, and you're used to, you know, just kind of showing up for your shift and doing what you need to do. And you would think, like, slicing bagels and making sandwiches isn't that hard. But everything was a lesson with John, which I don't think I appreciated at the time. And I appreciate it.
Well, you were what, 16, you said?
Yeah. And now, I mean, I look back and some of the things, you know, I've learned from John are just things that I've carried with me through the rest of my life into my career. And, you know, he knew when to be tough on you and he knew when to be kind. And he could, you know, do both at the exact right time. And I think that is something that makes a great boss.
Margaret, what would you say to that?
Well, I've had a lot of interesting Facebook messages and emails and exchanges, phone conversations with people that worked with John, including his nieces, Carolyn and Jessica, mm-hmm. Andrew, Annie, and Patty. And one of the things that really stood out to me was John's ability to teach people lessons but not give them the answers. And Liz spoke on that as well. I remember one time I made the rare mistake of burning probably 3 pans of bagels. I left them in too long. I didn't set the timer. John was there, unfortunately. and so we're sitting there and he smells the burning and he, you know, starts slamming stuff around. He, you know, he's mad. He's a tough guy. So, you know, I took the bagels out and I was so angry with myself, and he comes in and he says, I said, John, don't even start with me. I know you're going to yell at me. I'm not scared of you. Just leave me alone. I know I made a mistake. And he goes, Marg, I know that. That's why I won't even say anything to you, because you're harder on yourself than I could ever be. It's all right. So there's that mix of that beautiful mix of toughness and kindness that I think, you know, I think is a great quality in a boss.
Mm. There was a day that I was in there having a soup and sandwich with Paul DePascal, and Paul, we're eating, and Paul says, he kind of elbows me in the ribs, and he says, watch this. And I said, what? And he said, watch what just happened. A guy walked in, left the door open, and then was on his cell phone when he tried to order. And John goes, uh-uh, try again, go out, come back in, close the door, talk to me like a human being. And the guy went out and left, and he did not come back in. And Paul was laughing. And I said, I'm like, John, like, you just lost a customer. And he's like, that guy wouldn't have made this store any better. He's like, nobody wants to be around a guy like that. And I'm going, wow, I love that about him. I mean, did you see that once in a while, Mark?
Oh, yeah. The cell phone rule was I think it was posted maybe
I think
somewhere.
It actually got posted eventually. Yeah.
Because, you know, it became such a thing. And he would literally refuse service to someone who was on their cell phone. And he would tell them, you need to finish your call and come up when you're ready to order. And I still, to this day, you know, partially I'd like to think that it's my own, awareness of people, but to this day, I will never talk to anyone, that, you know, I would never talk on the phone while I'm having a conversation. I will never talk on the phone when I'm, you know, grabbing coffee at 7-Eleven. I would never talk on the phone during an interaction with anyone.
I'd like to see that made. It's just a citywide, ruling that. Put your cell phone away.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Liz? Did you see that once in a while?
Oh, yeah. Saw it all the time. And I do the same if I'm walking into the grocery store. I, you know, tell whoever, I'll call them back. I just can't do it. And I think it probably is largely in part working at Obagolo's.
Show respect for the person you're directly communicating with.
Mm-hmm.
But Jeff Spivak, based on John's firmness on that, once in a while, someone would say, where are you going to lunch? And I would say, Obagolo's. And they would say, oh, you're going down to see that blank. You know, I mean, like, some people, you know, viewed John that way.
Do you think he cared?
Well, that's the thing. I'm curious to know, because you're someone who you've critiqued art, music, et cetera. And some people, I think, get painted with a brush because they have high standards or because they care about the details. And they set those standards and they stick to them, even if that costs them a little bit here and there. I mean, John's reputation, I think, is pretty sterling. But at the same time, there were people out there who viewed him as that gruff guy or that blank, that so-and-so. I guess I'm asking if you think that's okay, or if that's like, I mean, is that part of the cost of having those standards?
Well, I think we've seen so many standards decay over the centuries. Perhaps we should think that John was on the right path there, that, look, treat the person you are with or you're talking to with the kind of respect that you would expect. And just let's stop putting things between us like I'm in the middle of a cell phone conversation, or, you know, this person is more relevant to you at the moment. You should be, as John, I believe, you guys may correct me on this or not, or maybe he was not this way, but I felt he was this way, that he was talking to you, and that's the thing of the moment that was mm-hmm. most important. And if his cell phone, mm-hmm. somebody's cell phone's going off, it'll wait.
Well, think about it, Jeff. I mean, like, I'm sure Liz and Margaret can affirm this. If he's talking to you, he's the busiest guy in the room there. If he's giving you mm-hmm. his attention, he darn well should get it from you. Is that fair?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Margaret and I were talking earlier. There was a judge who, at the time, he was probably in his 80s, but being so young, he seemed like he was 120 years old. And he would come in for lunch, and John never sat down. I mean, he was always busy. But he would sit down and have lunch with this judge, and he would stop everything he was doing, and he was so present. And, you know, at the time, sometimes it was annoying. It was like, well, you know, we needed you to do this, or, you know, but he was so good about that. And later, I, you know, living across the street, I'd be going somewhere and see him on his porch reading and go over and say hello. And I knew better than to look at my cell phone to check the time. And I was late for things on multiple occasions because he was so great to have conversations with. But, you know, he was in it and, you know, respected your presence, and you felt like you had to do the same.
You see, Margaret, once in a while, as I get older, I try to remind myself not to be get off my lawn guy. You know, that norms change, technology changes, and that in many ways, I've got to try to keep up, right? I think this is one of those things where not only was John Vito right, I think that we all are going to have to challenge ourselves to do this, to be more present for each other, to not go to dinner or have dinner at home and be on your phone the whole time, to be present with the people in the group that you're with, to literally not text someone who's standing 8 feet away from you. I don't think that that's necessarily get off my lawn guy material. I think that this is like an actual important cultural moment, but maybe I'm just get off my lawn guy. Maybe John was. What do you think?
I think he was a little bit of both. I think he really enjoyed his gruff side, and he enjoyed and kind of reveled in a little bit of anger because and discomfort, because I think, again, I believe that John, like a lot of us, knows that, you know, you're going to learn so much more through times of discomfort than you would when everybody's nice to each other. And you don't sit, you know, you don't cover things that are difficult. But he definitely loved that rule, that cell phone rule. And if someone walked out, that would absolutely make his week. And he would tell all of his friends about it and how proud he was about that. So I think that's a great story that you just told.
Well, and so as we get ready to wrap this program, we've talked a lot about the community that John built at Obagolos. Jack from Rochester called in to say he thinks the name Obagolos came from the fact that John started with a partner who was Irish and put the O on the front and then the O on the back for the Italian part of his name. So you had the Obagolos, which sounded Irish-Italian to John. There you go, Jeff Spivak. I didn't know that story.
First time for me, too. That's okay. Great.
But I think we're getting verification.
Yes, that is true. And John was Italian. I'm proudly Irish, so maybe that's one of the reasons why we got along so well over several years. But that was definitely the story, because it's such it's a remarkable and unique name that, you know, comes off the tongue. People would, up until, you know, a few weeks ago, many people just called him Obagolos.
Yeah.
That's what they call it. Yeah.
Hey, Obagolos. Yeah. I heard that many. I think Paul DePascal did that. I'm not even sure he knew John's. He knew John's name. But in our last couple of minutes here, the community was people who, they loved the quote board. They loved the ethos. They loved the attention to detail, the quality of all of the food, the quality of the conversation, even if not everyone agreed. It was an interesting community. Jeff, how are we going to build a community or a society again where we can do that?
It's not that we don't have the people. I would look to, you know, and I like small places, so I would look to a place like Danny Deutsch at Abilene Bar and Grill, Bar and Lounge, where you can go in there after work and sit down and have a glass of wine, and there's some people talking around you, and you can listen in. And Danny, like the same experience you had in Obagolos, nurtures little conversations like that, mm-hmm. Political, music, whatever. So they are out there, but we need to be with there. We need to be sitting in that restaurant or that bar and chatting with this very interesting person who really is not only just totally attached to the city, but really wants to have a conversation about it and make sure we're going in the right direction. That was John. There are others out there.
30 seconds, Liz.
So I work in marketing, and there's this whole movement towards, you know, customer experience. And I was thinking about it before I came on the show, and it's like John Vito did customer experience better than anyone else before it was a thing. Like, he just, you know, every single detail he, you know, was meticulous about. And it showed, and it paid off, and it did create this wonderful community where people wanted to be, and I hope we can replicate that.
Margaret, what do you think?
I just take away, you know, John was a very close friend of mine for a long time. Just being a good friend to people and reaching out to people regularly, I think that's one of the lessons I also learned in the isolation of the pandemic. That's really important to me, to be a good friend as well as have good friends around me. And I'm very grateful and lucky to have someone like John and many others who are just remarkable people. And, you know, I would go into war with them.
If you know someone whose health, especially kidney health, has struggled, John's Cooking for Your Kidneys will live on. Share that. Share it. And be proud to do that. His standards were very high. If you became a regular in his shop and he was friendly with you, but if you broke one of those rules, he was still ready to throw you out of the shop. High standards are a good thing, and John always had them. John Vito, thank you for everything you have done for our community. Margaret, thank you.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Liz,
I appreciate
thank you
it.
So much. Thank oh, you. My gosh. Thank you. And Jeff Spivak, wonderful.
Sure. Glad to help.
Rob Braden, Emery Stein, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson saying thanks for listening. Hope you're building a beautiful community wherever you are, and we're back with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.